You're listening to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. Let's get started. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 403 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and this is a Bits and Pieces episode. If you've been with us for a while, you know what that means, but if you're new to the show, let me explain. We record Airplane Geeks every Monday, but sometimes Monday is a national holiday, and we want to spend the day with our families and friends. We don't want to leave you without a show to listen to, so we put together something we call Bits and Pieces. The Bits and Pieces idea is simple. We ask the co-hosts and other contributors to provide a pre-recorded segment for the episode. Then we just stitch them together, and it's Bits and Pieces. Here's what's coming up this episode. We have two very interesting interviews that David recorded at NASA Langley Research Center. David talks with Dr. Richard Walls, the Advanced Air Vehicles Program Strategic Technical Advisor, about the new X-Plane program. The second interview is with Peter Cohn. He's the Commercial Supersonic Technology Project Manager. They talk about shaping the boom. Then Brian Coleman comments on long TSA lines. Rob Mark has another On the Mark segment, this one titled Don't Let Congress Cut the NTSB's TV Time. Then listener Gary tells us the story of buying his own Piper PA-38 Tomahawk. And our main man Micah brings us a timely update to his piece, News Reporting and the Sport of Speculation, or The Surge in Sensational Surrealism. All right then, let's get started. David Vanderhoof spent a day at NASA Langley Research Center, or LRC, which is adjacent to Joint Base Langley-Eustis, and he recorded several interviews. NASA LRC is leading the charge to revitalize focus on the first A in NASA, aeronautics. The first interview is with Dr. Richard Walls, the Advanced Air Vehicles Program Strategic Technical Advisor. David and Dr. Walls talk about the new X-Plane program and how it is focusing on environmental issues to make commercial, GA, and military aviation greener.
This is David. I'm pleasantly happy in Langley Air Force Base, NASA's research facility. We are right now speaking with Dr. Richard Walls. Dr. Walls, thank you for being on Airplane Geeks, and tell us a little bit about your career first. How did you start? What did you go to school? And then we'll go talk about the X-Planes.
Well, I started at North Carolina State University in aerospace engineering. Went all the way through bachelor's to PhD in aerospace engineering at State. I got involved with NASA through, as a graduate student, spent time here and back in Raleigh on campus. Got to know people at Langley, ended up getting a job with a local contractor working at this facility we're in now, the National Transonic Facility. Became a civil servant in 91. Has spent my career doing applied aerodynamics, configuration aerodynamics, improving prediction tools, and have evolved over the years to span out and take on program responsibilities that go beyond aerodynamics into propulsion and structures and that sort of thing. But my background is more aerodynamics.
Tell us a little bit about the facility we're in.
This facility, the U.S. National Transonic Facility, or NTF, is unique in this country, the first of its kind in the world. It's a high-pressure, cryogenic transonic wind tunnel, meaning you can take a 2.5% scale model of a transport aircraft and test at the flight Mach number and, more importantly, what makes it unique, the flight Reynolds number. So you're effectively kind of scaling the air, the flow, down to the model size so you get the right physics.
Administrator Bolden, who has been on our show multiple times, has a couple of weeks ago brought out the revitalization of the X-Plane program. Now, we're going to talk a little bit later about Quest, but maybe you could start talking about three of the four projects besides the Quest program. Let's talk about the first one, which is the efficient hybrid wing body, otherwise known as the blended wing body, as as I've grown to know it. But why don't you talk about that and what that means to the future of air transport?
Well, so backing up just a second, there's in the X-Plane program, when it was rolled out in the president's proposal, there were five demonstrators, and one is the Quest, which you're going to see. And then there were three that were subsonic transport oriented, and a fourth one then is subsonic transport oriented, but with electric, hybrid electric propulsion rolled in. And we're going to end up, assuming we get the budget for everything, we're planning for, you know, there'll be competitions, and we talk in terms of, in the subsonic world, of a fully integrated demonstrator that could be a hybrid wing or blended wing body aircraft. It could be something else, but you know, those are the ones that are, I think, most ready from an alternative configuration standpoint. And then we'd have some purpose-built demonstrations. And the difference there is, you know, when we say fully integrated, it's more you've built it from scratch. You're doing the total integrated benefit. It's got the structure. It's got the aero. It's got the latest propulsion on it. And the purpose-built might be more of, if you think of taking something like the truss brace wing, which we have on the, you know, you see pictures around my office of, you could demonstrate that by rewinging an existing vehicle. So you're not doing a totally brand new airplane. You're targeting a specific technology, for example. So to your question, you know, what's the benefit of these to the future? You know, we develop a lot of technologies in the lab, in the wind tunnels. We talk a lot about the valley of death and technology readiness and how you transfer these technologies to the people in industry who can actually make the decisions to use them and market them and on products. And this valley of death that we have, probably it gets more expensive, takes often, you know, bigger types of demonstrations. And that's what we're talking about with these X-planes and some other studies to bridge that gap. The concepts themselves, you know, we put out challenging goals that will reduce the energy consumption or fuel burn. We've started to say energy consumption instead of just fuel burn because, as I mentioned earlier, we've kind of introduced the idea of hybrid electric. So now it's not all just jet fuel, and you have to look at how you're accounting for energy use. You know, you could use less jet fuel but use more energy, and that wouldn't be a win necessarily, that kind of thing. And in addition to the fuel burn, you know, the biggest impediment to the growth of the transportation system now is the noise around airports. And if you can make the aircraft quiet enough to where people won't call every time one is coming in for a landing, you know, you could fly overnight without penalty, without annoying people, and so the throughput could get even larger.
Yeah, well, and unfortunately, this audience, you get reduced the noise, they're going to be very unhappy.
Yeah.
We like the sound of jet noise. I live right in the end of the pattern at Philadelphia International Airport, so I like the sound of jet noise. It doesn't bother me, but my father was base civil engineer for the Air Force.
Yeah.
At Willow Grove.
It's the sound of freedom.
Yeah, but, you know, when you get letters saying that the 130s are keeping a woman's cats up all night, even though they weren't flying from 11 o'clock to 6 o'clock in the morning. I get the whole noise abatement thing.
Yeah.
But let's talk a little bit more about electric power, because that seems to be the future of where we're going. The two programs that in the sheet that Administrator Boulder came out with was, and we're going to talk, you're going to hear a lot of acronyms, folks, on the next couple of days. one was STARC and the other one was SCEPTR.
Okay.
STARC, I guess, is geared towards the civil world. SCEPTR's geared towards maybe more general aviation.
Yes, but they're related, and we've worked hard to try to relate them. Our strategy within NASA is in part to be able to use the small aircraft market to learn about systems, about all the things involved with electric systems on aircraft for propulsion. Transport aircraft are more and more electric now. I think 787 is a 1.5 megawatts of power, electric power on the airplane. But it's not used for propulsion, and we're trying to move it into propulsion. So Scepter is about, it's a test bed, it's a small aircraft. It's teaching us about electromagnetic interference and thermal management within the wing, and how you package, can everything fit within
batteries.
The wing. And on top of that, then it also has a distributed propulsion benefit. So it's where you put the fans or the propulsors on the wing, and if you're blowing over the wing, you can increase the speed and get more lift out of the wing. And it's not just the propulsion; it's how it can make the whole total aircraft better. And we kind of see that if we can learn small, and we can spin off some of these technologies to the GA market or the small commuter market. We'll also, as a community, learn about what it takes to certify such a system. We'll also learn sooner about how they operate out in the operational environment, for example. But we're also learning about the systems, and the power systems will have to be much larger for the single aisle transport kind of size. But we should be learning, all the learning we're doing there should apply up, even if the systems won't be exactly the same. The Stark is a single aisle transport. The icon looks sort of like a 717 kind of vehicle with a tail cone rotor, so like a third fan at the back. And that honestly can be driven either with electric systems, or it doesn't have to be electric systems. There's potential propulsive and aerodynamic benefit, whether it's electric or whether it's not. But there are concepts that take power off the engines on the wing, route it back, and drive that tail cone propulsor. It's, in effect, a distributed propulsion, but we also call it a turboelectric propulsion because you're still carrying around jet fuel. You still have a core combustor on the wing, and that's what generates the power, and you're just routing the power electrically back. So it's not
kind of like a hybrid car with the gas part fueling the battery to
kind of, except so there are other concepts like the H fan that came out of the trust. It was a study we funded with Boeing that was called Sugar, or Subsonic Ultra Green Aircraft Research, and great name. You could go into all the names, the refined sugar, the sugar high, the refined sugar. There's a whole suite of those that you got to get into. But the Sugar Volt was the electric one. And that was a lot more like a Prius, where you had a core gas engine, but you also had batteries that don't exist today, but projected batteries. And you could run, power the propulsor, spin the propulsor with either the gas or the electric, the battery. The challenge with the batteries is, the weight of them. So the energy and power density of the batteries, and you could put enough on there but they'd be too heavy and the benefit would all go away. So we see a lot of investment. I think everybody sees a lot of investment in the U.S. and around the world in the energy sector, focused on cars, focused on the grid, focused on everything. And so it's you might have heard Administrator Bolden use the term convergent technology. And so that's kind of looking to these other sectors and saying, I don't need to invent the battery because everybody else is working on that, but I better darn well be ready to use it when, the weights of those batteries come down, the energy and power densities come down.
You talk more about systems. Historically, the X-planes originally, like the XS-1 and the X-2, they were designed to do one thing. It looks like now NASA's focusing on trying to get, and this is us taxpayers going, we're happy with this, more bang for the buck. You're trying to get one aircraft to do multiple integrations and stuff. These five aircraft, are going to be focusing on not just one problem, but multiple problems. Does that make it easier or harder?
Some of each. I think, if I had the goal of breaking the sound barrier, you have very singular focus and I'm just trying to prove I can do it. And it might not have to then be as directly transferable to a product, you know, kind of a balanced design. It's, can I do it? And if you're trying to do a fully integrated kind of vehicle design, you can't afford to do the prototype. And we're not chartered with the government. We're not doing the prototype for Boeing or Lockheed. You know, we're demonstrating technology. So where do you compromise to make the X-plane that gives you the integrated demonstration versus building a Y-plane, which is like a prototype, a real prototype that more easily transfers to a product? So there's pros and cons. It's, you know, it's sometimes easier, sometimes harder.
So where are we 5 years from now?
Hopefully we're flying two of these X-planes up in the air. Hopefully by now, I think. I think, you know, the one that's off and running, you're going to hear about next, the Quest. And that's really more of a, Peter will talk more about it, but that's more of the purpose of looking at the sonic boom and showing you can make the whisper, the puff, the whatever.
The thump. I have been reading about the thump all week long in preparation for these interviews.
You can edit my part of that out.
No. It's
but,
fine.
But yeah, in 5 years, we should be seeing that fly. And we should be either flying or well on the way to flying the second one. And the third and fourth should be in the design phase. So if all goes well with politics and Congress and elections
and the
presidents
money.
And yeah, which is all tied to the money. We have the support right now of the administration, and I mean, it's so exciting to actually see the proposal from the president include all this, because it allows us to talk about it and say, here's what we're planning to do. And in NASA, we work in the executive branch, so we work for the president, and the president's saying we're going to go do this. So it's exciting. Yeah, it kind of changes the game really on how we are able to plan and talk about it.
As I'm known to say, it's nice to see that there's an A in NASA again.
Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
So it's a really exciting time, I think, to reach these goals of, I mean, we put out 50-60% reduction in energy consumption and cutting the perceived noise in half, those kind of things. There's no silver bullet. And so you'll see us working structures technology to make aircraft lighter, structures technology to have higher temperatures in engines to make them more efficient. Propulsion, that's where the high temperature comes in. That's where, you know, can we bring in the electric? But it's far beyond just the electric, because those core gas turbine engines need a lot of advancement too. Higher pressure ratios, more efficient components, that sort of thing. And then aerodynamics, you know, back to my roots, you know, the shape of the airplane. I mean, you like to see the shape of that blended wing body. It looks very aerodynamic, and it is. And some other shapes, you know, we're looking around, you know, truss brace wings. That's one where people look at it and go, well, gee, doesn't that look like something we did 50 years ago? And I'll say, yeah, there's airplanes flying around with struts now, but not at Mach 0.8. efficiently. And what that strut does is it enables kind of a design change mindset, and it lets you change the sweep of the wing and the thickness of the wing without getting weight penalties, and so it's less intuitive, you know, because you're putting more surface area out there, but in an overall integrated sense, it can be a very, very much more efficient kind of shape. It's just very exciting, and no silver bullet. We need to be looking at it all to get these, you know, big changes.
Dr. Wallace, thank you so much for being on the show and taking some time, and hopefully you'll come back on the show maybe in a year or so, and we'll learn more, and we'll see how far we've progressed, and hopefully you'll have some silver bullet, as you said. There isn't one, but maybe you find one.
Yeah.
So again, thank you so much for being on Airplane Geeks.
Thank you very much. I'd be very, very happy to come back again.
The next interview is with Peter Cohn. He's the Commercial Supersonic Technology Project Manager. They talk about shaping the boom by changing the shape of the aircraft. While not eliminating the boom, it does reduce its impact on the ground.
I'm in the office here with Peter Cohn. we're going to talk a little bit about something NASA's been talking about since the beginning when it was NACA, which is sonic booms. Thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me a little bit about how you got to NASA.
So I graduated from Polytechnic Institute in New York in 1983. Came here to NASA for what I thought was going to be a short stay, and it's turned into quite a career. I really found kind of a home in doing supersonic research. I've been involved in pretty much all of the NASA main supersonic research programs since the high-speed research program started in 1987.
NASA has been quietly, and working on sonic boom research from the beginning. Let's talk a little bit about where we're leading up to. Let's start off with, and you guys like acronyms that have a lot to do with the aircraft, like WHISPER and FAINT and the F-5 shaped sonic boom demonstrator, and most recently NASA NA-36, the AOA probe tests out at NASA Armstrong, and then we'll go into Quest. So how have we been moving along with supersonic technology and sonic boom technology?
So you're right. NASA and NACA before us has been studying sonic booms and how to eliminate them essentially since the first sonic boom was heard. If you look back, the actual theory, well, there's a lot of work in understanding all about sonic booms. When they first started happening, you know, people were worried, did they cause avalanches? Did they cause earthquakes? You know, would they interrupt surgeons if they were operating? There were a lot of questions, a lot of unknowns. So NASA was key in really just in taking a lot of data, doing a lot of flight campaigns, and getting a real understanding of what sonic booms did and what they did not do. They did not do all of those other things. But then the idea really became, how do you get rid of it? How do you change those shock waves into something that's less offensive? And if you look, that theory actually dates back to the late 1960s. Two fellows by the name of Al George and Richard Seabass came up with the original math behind how you would change the pressure distribution around an airplane into something that did not contain shock waves. It took a long time to get to where we are now, gradually working from kind of this just the pure math to can you incorporate it into something that actually looks like an airplane. But what we've done most recently is we've kind of made the breakthrough is using computational tools and new design approaches, we can actually make a practical airplane that has essentially a ground signature that you measure after the airplane passes overhead that has no boom in it. It's a thump instead of a boom.
What is that shape? What was the breakthrough?
So this is one of these things where you try and squeeze it into a short explanation. Essentially what happens is because shock waves happen really because the air doesn't know the plane is coming. Shock waves are pressure disturbances. They travel out in all directions from their source at the speed of sound. So if the airplane's flying faster than sound, essentially it's getting there before its pressure signal can. So all the pressure changes happen instantaneously. We call that a shock wave. Near the airplane, there are lots of shock waves. There's one on the nose, there's one on the canopy, there's one from the wing. The engine nacelles contribute a big shock wave. They're all different strengths and they're all different positions on the airplane. That signal travels out, and very shortly, those signals, all those shock waves have merged into just two signals. So by the time you reach the ground, you have a boom boom from two sharp pressure increases separated by a very gradual decrease in the middle. You don't hear that gradual increase. All you hear is the two booms. The idea behind boom reduction is to keep those shock waves from merging so that the atmosphere attenuates them. It changes them from being very sharp sounds to more gradual sounds. So what you wind up on the bottom is what you wind up on the ground is instead of a rapid instantaneous pressure increase, you have a gradual pressure rise, a gradual pressure decrease, and then another gradual pressure rise back to ambient conditions. So thump, thump instead of bang, bang.
Let's talk about the newest program, which is Quest.
Okay, so in the past 10 years, really, we have made something of a breakthrough in terms of really being able to understand how to design a practical airplane that has a really low boom signal. We've tested in the wind tunnel. It was really ready to be tested in flight. So not only would a flight demonstration be a big benefit to understanding the technology, it's really key because right now you can't fly over land at supersonic speeds because of sonic booms. They were much too loud. So the FAA eventually wrote a rule that said no flight greater than Mach 1. So in order to have supersonic commercial aircraft, we have to overturn that rule. In order to overturn that rule, we have to understand how people react to a thump instead of a boom. So the new Aviation's Horizons program, the first of several demonstrators in that program, is what we call the Quest, the Quiet Supersonic Technology Demonstration. And the idea of that is to build this airplane, quantify its acoustic characteristics, but ultimately go out and fly over people and gather their reaction, which hopefully will be very small, so that the regulators, eventually the FAA and others in the international community, can say, all right, we'll make a rule, just like the current takeoff and landing noise rules, that says as long as you're below this sound level, we'll certify your airplane for supersonic flight.
Tell me what Quest looks like. It's a very pointy airplane.
Right. So, again, you're trying to control the shock waves as they initially form. So you want a series of shock waves that are close as possible to the same strength and also fairly evenly spaced apart. So you want a long nose so that initial pressure rise builds up slowly and doesn't cause a large shock wave. Beyond that, the airplane kind of looks like any other supersonic airplane. It's got a highly swept wing. Where the real differences are like the engine nacelle installation, because you want to manage the shock waves from those engine nacelles. So you either have to carefully design the shape of the wing if you're going to put the engines under the wing, or you have to put them on top. Now, that's talking about an airliner. For Quest, we're talking about a research airplane. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to make it practical, inexpensive to build, but capable of simulating the signal of a future actual aircraft. So in this case, the Quest airplane has a single engine. It's mounted on top, again, to mitigate that shock wave, and it's a very long, slender airplane. It's about the wingspan of an F-16, but it's about twice as long as an F-16.
We were talking in our previous interview about scalability. Mm-hmm. And this demonstrator, is it going to be... Are they going to be like Boeing and Lockheed, or if they wanted to build, or let's say Bombardier wants to build, or Cessna wants to build a biz jet that's supersonic, is this technology going to be scalable up to something that's going to have a fuselage and a 20-passenger or a single aisle, or will that be step two? Will there have to be another aircraft after it?
Well, it's not a prototype, but the design technology, the actual use of computational tools and the selection of the design of the near field design target is something that's applicable to larger scale airplane. And what we've tested in the wind tunnel so far is actually designs for small supersonic airliners. NASA recognizes that obviously the business jet is kind of the first product of opportunity, but we're trying to push the technology a little bit further so more and more people get access to supersonic flight. So yes, the shaping technology itself is applicable to other aircraft other than the demonstrator. The demonstrator itself is kind of a convenient way to get that acoustic signal up into the air so that we can understand how people are going to react to it.
It's interesting. We got to get an airplane up in the air so the people on the ground can pay attention to it. Or not pay attention to it.
That's the hope.
I guess that would be the better goal. Where are we as far as we've got wind tunnel tests? When might we see and not hear this prototype fly?
So as part of the budget, the president's budget for this year, for fiscal year 16, we were given money to proceed through the end of the preliminary design. So we'll have essentially all the design features determined and some of the wind tunnel testing to validate the performance of the aircraft completed. if we get approval for the next phase, that's the detailed design and build phase, could start as early as next year in 2017. If that happens, we should be ready to fly by the end of 2019. We'll do what's called flight clearance, make sure the airplane is safe to fly and performs the way it's supposed to. Then we'll do acoustic validation, make sure we're actually getting the signal that we thought we were going to get. And then the following phase, which would be in about 2021, would be the first of those community response tests.
Well, that answers my where are we in 5 years question.
Yeah. There you go.
That takes us out to 2021. Yeah. Is it practical? Is it happening? I talked to some of my friends, and we talked about Concorde, and I seriously asked a lot of my friends who are from Great Britain and stuff, was it a viable airliner? I mean, did they actually make money with it? And it was yes, but with a giant asterisk, considering Britain and France paid for all the development of it.
Sure. Once they wrote off the development costs, arguably it made money on its operations. So boom is not really the only technology that we really need to have in hand to have practical supersonic business jets. Or practical supersonic airliner, certainly. The business jet is a little bit less sensitive to fuel consumption, so if it's not quite as efficient, as long as it doesn't have boom, meets takeoff and landing noise requirements, another very important item, and doesn't emit too much in the way of harmful emissions, it can probably be successful. Due to its smaller size. In order to get to the larger airplane, we really need to continue to work on the aerodynamic efficiency. We need to find ways to find a low boom solution that is also extremely low drag, investigate drag reducing technologies such as laminar flow, improved propulsion systems to drive that efficiency up to the point where you can make airliner type operations. The big difference will be at least in NASA's approach, is if you don't have the barrier of not being able to fly over land, the airlines could envision using an airplane in their day-to-day operations throughout their fleet. That was the big thing about Concorde. If you can only fly it back and forth over the water, you can't integrate it into your operations. So, the airlines didn't want it, no sales. More sales, obviously helps, reduces your initial cost or amortizes your initial cost, and then the manufacturers and the airlines can make money on the actual day-to-day operations.
Is there any other day-to-day roles that you have that on the periphery besides Quest? Or is it all filtering through that?
No, I do want to stress that the emphasis on our project right now is the sonic boom. Like we say, that's the barrier that needs to come down. There are other technologies that we're working quite aggressively, particularly noise and emissions reduction. As we get through the Quest project and really understand whether or not the boom is going to be acceptable, we'll move back into looking at some of those other performance and efficiency technologies critical for future generations of products.
I appreciate you being on Airplane Geeks. Thank you so much. And I hope not to hear this, but I hope to see it fly someday.
You're very welcome. I hope you don't get to hear it either.
David also recorded two other interviews at NASA Langley. He spoke with Dr. Allen about the Autonomy Incubator, and that can be found at theuavdigest.com/145. David also talked with Frank Jones about sense and avoid technology and SUAS package delivery. Find that at theuavdigest.com/149, which will be released a few days after this episode of Airplane Geeks. You can follow NASA Langley on Twitter at NASA_Langley, LANGLEY, or you can visit their website, www.nasa.gov/Langley. Now we have Brian Coleman talking about long TSA lines.
Hey, Rob. Sorry I missed the last few shows, but I've been on the road and stuck in TSA security lines. I've been meaning to comment on your On the Mark segment from a few weeks ago. Yes, the lines at the airport are much longer than usual, And I was happy to hear the head of TSA was given the opportunity to explore other career opportunities somewhere else. However, what I have an issue with and what I comment about today is you telling people about the TSA Trusted Traveler Program, better known as PreCheck and Global Entry. Why in the world would you want to let people know about these programs and make my line longer? Come on, you know I travel a lot. Having more people sign up for the program's just going to have me spend more time in line, and that's exactly what I don't want to do. Yes, most certainly when the TSA started the program, I was one of the first to jump on board and submit my application. Paying the $100 was a no-brainer for me. Heck, I would have paid $500 not to have to take off my shoes, remove my laptop and baggie of 3-ounce bottles. It's a real time saver for me. And plus, with all the security theater that's going on, I really don't feel safer anyway. So having to do all these extra things, it's just a waste of my time. So Rob, please do us a favor and don't mention the TSA PreCheck or Global Entry program to anyone. Our lines are long enough. And if you're traveling this holiday weekend, I'm sure you will concur. They really are crazy long. I just hope the new TSA administrator can sort out the issues and provide real security for us. A failure rate of 96% in detecting explosives and other prohibited items just isn't good enough, and it sure doesn't make me feel safe and secure when I'm traveling the friendly skies. This is Brian Coleman, associate producer of the Airplane Geeks, finally home and not looking forward to the crowded lines next week when I'm back on the road.
Rob Mark has another On the Mark segment, this one titled, Don't Let Congress Cut the NTSB's TV Time. Here's Rob.
I'm Rob Mark, and this is On the Mark. Since reality television seems to have worked its way into our national political debate these days, I shouldn't have been too surprised that someone created an unpleasant link between reality TV and the aviation industry. But in this case, it claimed the National Transportation Safety Board, one of the few shining stars in the U.S. government, had knowingly taken part in a reality show. Suddenly, I had visions of Survivor and Real Housewives. Alaska's Senator Lisa Murkowski last month took the NTSB to task over a Smithsonian Channel show called Alaska Air Crash Investigators. The show tells the story of how the board's investigative team determines the probable cause of fatal aviation accidents in Alaska. In a letter to the NTSB chairman, Christopher Hart, the senator accused the board of going Hollywood and sensationalizing the board's investigative work. Murkowski even said her sensibilities were offended and called the NTSB reckless for subjecting Alaskans to potentially negative public opinion. Now, her letter to the NTSB also asked for detailed answers to 19 different questions about the board's involvement with the show. The NTSB had reckless? What I saw when I watched the shows was a superb documentary created with great photography that made me want to go buy a ticket to Anchorage. The show also pointed out the vital role aviation plays in Alaska, where only 20% of the state's accessible by road. That means, as the NTSB spokesman said in the show, airplanes are a way of life for nearly everyone in the state of Alaska. Now, more than once, I heard an investigator mention their personal anguish when interviewing victims' family members and the efforts those investigators take to try to be sensitive to the situation. Now, I realize as an industry guy, I'm probably a little biased, but I was fascinated by how the show explained investigator efforts to piece together what happened in each accident in order to prevent a similar tragedy. Clearly, Senator Murkowski's office must have had a few angry phone calls from the business community who worried the series would, quote, leave a lasting impression in the minds of Alaska's visitors that it's unsafe to participate in activities like flight seeing and fly-in fishing, while nothing of the kind is true. Really? Calling the board reckless because they participated in a documentary explaining the investigative process, it just focuses the light of responsibility in the wrong direction, I think. Might I suggest the senator rewatch episode 2, for instance, when the reason for that accident appears to have been a series of unauthorized engine modifications made by a local Alaskan operator? Then maybe the senator could try convincing the FAA to have a chat with more Alaskan pilots about flying safely. To me, Senator, rather than worrying whether the NTSB wasted taxpayer money or resources on something you seem to think was frivolous, you might want to consider the resources the board personnel are going to waste answering all of those questions of yours about their involvement in the show. From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark.
We love aviation stories from you, particularly when you record them so we can play them in your own voice. Listener Gary tells us his story of buying his own Piper PA-38 Tomahawk.
Hello, airplane geeks. My name is Gary, and in 2010, I did what not many of us get a chance to do. That is, buy my very own airplane. Not as part of a partnership, not as part of a club, but my very own plane. One that I could fly anywhere I wanted and whenever I wanted and tie down it for extended periods at remote airports without considering the daily minimal rental costs. This is a story of that purchase. First, a little background. In 2003, I finally received my pilot's license after wanting to fly forever. The kids were finally out of the house, and having a few extra dollars, I was in a position to attend ground school. The private pilot's license is a story in and of itself, beginning with abandoning my wife on our 25th anniversary to do a 5-minute checkout of a light sport airplane, and that turning into a 3-hour BS session with the wife waiting in the car, working through the FAA special issuance for diabetes, and on and on. I am fortunate, however, in that my wife has encouraged me to follow my passion. Or sickness, as she calls it. What she was unaware of is just how sick I really am. In June of 2010, I took an early retirement from Pratt & Whitney, based in Connecticut, and went to work for General Electric Energy in Greenville, South Carolina. As a result of the move, I was forced to sell my share of a flying club that had a Cherokee, a 172, and a Mooney. This was the first time I was planeless since receiving my ticket, and I felt out of place. In the years prior to the club, I was also part owner of a Cessna 152. For about 4 months, I was living in a bachelor pad and looking for a house while my wife sold her place in Connecticut. Long story short, about 3 months into our forced separation, we had an offer on our house in Connecticut and made an offer on a place in South Carolina. Both the sale and purchase of the houses were completed with only minor hassles. Yeah, right. In the 4th month of separation, I began to look for another airplane. I had previously defined the requirements for the aircraft as the following. 1. Similar operating costs to a 152. 2. Performance equal to or better than a 152. 3. Longer time aloft than a 152. I wanted increased fuel capacity. 4. Wider cockpit and increased comfort. 5. A door on each side of the cockpit so I didn't have to crawl across the seats to get to the pilot seats. The requirements forced me into one of three options. First, an experimental. I already have a KR2 under construction, but after 5 years of building, I believe I have at least 2 more to go, and prior to buying the new house and building a shop, not much work could be done on this option, so it was out. Anyway, who wants to fly an experimental somebody else built? 2, a Beach Skipper. 3, a Piper Tomahawk. There may be other options that I missed, however, these appeared to be the most realistic. So, the search was on. I did all the traditional search things and contacted many sellers. The following may be of interest if you're looking to buy or sell a PA-38 or a BE-77 in the future. BE-77s for sale are few and far between. Most are privately owned and were in fair to good shape, but the owners feel the Beach name adds about 30% to the value of the aircraft, so prices ranged in $28,000 to $32,000 and up. And this was for a bare-bones equipped avionics stack. On to PA-38s. The PA-38, while not as plentiful in the used plane market as Cessna 150s and 152, they are available and come in every condition and equipped with as much avionics as you can put into the panel, if you want that. PA-38 former owners liked or loved their airplanes, but felt at the time of sale they had to give the plane away, and the final sales price was a negative to the overall ownership experience. The Tomahawk, or lawn dart perception, and the much smaller production of PA-38s versus Cessna 150s and 152s added to this giveaway feeling. I was told by several former owners that if I bought a Tommy, I had better plan on keeping it. Hey, isn't that what we all plan to do? I found my plane on eBay. When I saw the plane, there were 4 days left in the auction and zero bids. Opening bid was $12,000. Sounds like a great deal, right? Well, maybe and maybe not. While the airplane was well equipped, it had a 3,200-hour time-since-major overhaul engine on the nose. Ouch. A run-out claptrap. Maybe that's why no one bid. So I fire off an email to the seller and offer a lowball bid. I'm not going to tell you how low, but it was less than the core value of the 0235 hanging on the nose. To my surprise, when I checked the auction after it closed, nobody had bid on the Tomahawk. Next day, I received an email from the seller which said he had accepted my offer and wanted to know when I wanted to pick up the plane in Oklahoma City. Holy crap, Batman. I just bought a plane with a 3,200-hour engine. I made arrangements to pick up the plane, and the night before I left for Oklahoma City, I decided I would brief my wife on how my brand-new 460-megahertz locator beacon would alert her if I went down in this plane that I was buying. Since this was the first time she had heard about the plane, this was a somewhat difficult discussion. Let's just say I have been paying for the airplane ever since, and leave it at that. It turns out the seller was actually an aircraft dealer. A father and son operation. And when Tony, the son, picked me up at the airport Saturday morning, I found out why he had sold me the airplane at the low price. Daddy told him to get that Tomahawk out of the showroom. The inventory of the dealership was contained in a large customized hangar. The Tomahawk was taken in on trade for another aircraft and was basically an ugly duckling sitting next to the $1 million and up Piper Meridians and similar planes. I was given the run of the dealership. All the logs were laid out on the conference room table and all the tools were available to me. After spending 3 hours checking out the Tommy, pulling access plates, looking at cables and pulleys, compression check, and bore scoping the cylinders, I could not find anything that I was concerned about. On to the logs. The logs were interesting. The second owner had actually converted the plane to an experimental and back while developing an STC for the autopilot. Yes, this Tomahawk is the one with the STC autopilot. That's a separate story. At one time, there was a strike finder installed and then removed, and yes, the plane had a landing gear collapse due to the short bolts installed at the factory. There is an AD out on this. The paint was in good shape, although dated, and most of the plastic was good enough for a 30-plus-year-old airplane. Okay, so much for the airframe. On to the engine logs. It turns out that 3200 since major overhaul is just that, since major overhaul. But that doesn't tell the whole story. The engine had been topped several times with new cylinders and accessories along the way. It turns out the only thing that was 3200 hours was the lower end. Everything else had been replaced in the prior 700 hours. Now or never, test flight. Tony was ready to do the deal, and it was getting late. I wanted to get my airplane to South Carolina that day. A bit optimistic in retrospect, considering I left South Carolina at 9 a.m. on American. We flew to another airport where the fuel was about a dollar cheaper, and I could get the feel of the plane. The plane flew just fine, and my first landing in about 6 months was only a 7 on the Richter scale. On the way back to drop off Tony and pay the balance, he pointed to the fuel pressure gauge, which was sitting just to the right of zero. I flipped on the boost pump, and the needle moved well into the green. Okay, there's the first squawk I need to attend to. Never had to worry about that in a 152. Maybe that's why they put the wings on top. I dropped off Tony with the remainder of the purchase price, paid in cash, and after doing the paperwork, I was on my way to South Carolina from Oklahoma City. Made it most of the way that day, and by agreement with the wife, I phoned each time I stopped. In Alabama, I called, and I guess she could tell I was tired, and convinced me to get a hotel and some sleep. Considering my current standing and how much she loved the plane at this point, I took her suggestion, or rather mandate, and I finished the flight home the next day. So, how much does it cost to get a cheap Tomahawk into good shape? The cost to get my Tomahawk into its current shape includes the following. A new fuel pump, $400. First annual, $4,500. Ouch. By the way, I am an AMP, but not an AI. I currently have no place to work on the plane, and an owner-assisted annual was not realistic at this point. So yes, this was reasonable. Total investment to date is just short of $16,000, with miscellaneous items along the way. The engine is still going strong at 3,500 hours. Yes, I have put on 300 hours in just over a year. 50-hour oil filter changes and oil analysis at each change. Loney, the new name for the Tomahawk, burns 1 quart every 13 hours. I fly mostly 2 to 3 hour legs. I apply $30 an hour for annual and engine reserve. I know I'll need to change that out at some point. So far, I'm a happy Tomahawk owner. Now, if I can just get a hangar. For the Airplane Geeks, this is Gary.
Thanks for that, Gary. I think we may be hearing more from him about his Tomahawk. If you have a story you'd like our listeners to hear, contact us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. If you have some experience making audio recordings, great, have at it. If not, we'll give you some tips and help you sound great. Now, by popular request, Micah brings us a timely update to his piece, News Reporting and the Sport of Speculation, or The Surge in Sensational Surrealism. Here's our main man, Micah.
Thanks, Max. Now, regular listeners may have heard parts of this before, as it originally aired in April 2015 on Airplane Geeks episode 344, titled, It's All About Rob. Isn't it always, though? Anyway, based on recent events, I thought it might be worth updating a bit and retelling, as the scene hasn't really changed, and maybe it's gotten worse. So for this Memorial Day Bits and Pieces episode, here is News Reporting and the Sport of Speculation, or The Surge in Sensational Surrealism, Redux. Eighth grade geography class was a revelation to me, a class that has influenced me to this day, but maybe not in the way one would think a geography class might. Sure, I loved learning how to read maps, what legends meant, the scale, how to measure and judge distances. I loved learning about rivers, mountain ranges, plateaus, climates, all things I still use on an almost daily basis. But what had the most impact on me was learning about the news. News in a geography class? Well, yes, absolutely. Now, I still can't say exactly why it fit into eighth grade geography, but my teacher, Mr. Bowers, who was best known at school as the head football coach, required each and every one of his students to subscribe to the New York Times. It was delivered to his classroom daily and read with him every morning in class. Now, some kids, and even some of Mr. Bowers' fellow teachers, thought he was just lazy, trying to get himself through the day so he could get to football practice in the afternoon. But I never thought of him that way. I loved learning how to read a paper from him in class. Mr. Bowers taught me about news and how to understand it. He explained what it meant for a story to be above the fold, what the size of the headlines meant, how stories are placed throughout the paper. I learned how to scan down the middle of a newspaper column and get the gist of an article, what to look for in the first few paragraphs, and the summary in the last few. This wasn't taught from the perspective of journalism. It was to teach us how to read a newspaper, how to question reporting, to understand what sources meant, and how to scrutinize what was written. Now remember, this was in the days when the word vet meant someone who had been in the armed service, or a veterinarian. The draft was still in place, and the voting age was 21. The drinking age in many states was only 18. Watergate was just a building in Washington, D.C., but I digress. Let me just say that I learned to love to read newspapers. My mother and father, both avid readers and Sunday newspaper junkies, encouraged me. I look forward to Sunday afternoons. Together with my mom and dad, I would read the Sunday New York Times, the New York Daily News, and the Sunday Bergen Record. I would see what stories each paper was covering and how the editorial perspectives might differ. It was wonderful. I wanted to read every paper I could. I would save my allowance and go down to the candy store almost every day after school and pick up a different newspaper. That's when I found the National Enquirer. Something was different about this paper. It was not like the others I'd read. The National Enquirer was amazing, like reading books of science fiction and horror. It said there were real UFOs flying around us, that vampires really existed, and people had been brought back from the dead. This was fantastic. I bought it every week and read it cover to cover. One afternoon, I had the National Enquirer spread out on the dining room table as usual when my father happened to come home early and join me. "What are you reading?" he asked. Not that he didn't already know. So I showed him. "Oh, that's great," he said. "I hope you're enjoying it." I told him how much I liked it and how I've been reading it every week for the last 2 months. "I know," he said, "and that's fine. But you know the difference between what you're reading here and the New York Times, don't you?" I asked him what he meant, and he reminded me of the New York Times motto, "All the news that's fit to print." Then he went on to say that the rest of it, the news that's not fit to print, can often be found in the National Enquirer. My dad said that it was perfectly fine to read that other news, but to keep it in perspective. Now, my dad, Lou, was a psychologist by trade and one of the most brilliant men I've ever known. He turned this day into a great lesson for me. He taught me about the principle of Occam's razor, how when dealing with competing hypotheses that predict equally well, why the one with the fewest assumptions is most likely to be correct. In other words, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, well, it's probably a duck. It was from my dad that I first learned the phrase, when you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. Lou taught me about sensationalism and muckraking, how it's human nature to hunger for rumors, and how rumors come about when there's a desire for more information, but when there's no further information to be had. Now, sure, these may all be cliches, but these cliches are important. In fact, these are cliches that our current news media often forgets, and that thing referred to as social media almost never bears in mind. And by the way, from my perspective, the term social media is a misnomer. It's neither social nor media. It's mostly gossip, aggrandizement, or hype, as we never really know the source, and there's no real credibility. At any rate, some 50 years later, I still love the news, and I still read at least one newspaper every day. I love radio, too, something else I grew up with. When you combine the two, news and radio, well, now you really have something. Growing up, I always had two all-news radio stations coming to me in the New York metropolitan area. They're still there, WCBS and WINS. Now both owned by the same corporation, but still two different stations covering stories with differing content. I still remember the WINS motto by heart. You give us 22 minutes, and we'll give you the world. They still do. It works great on radio, but not so well on TV. TV news isn't news. Not anymore, anyway. It's become entertainment. I can tell you exactly when it changed to entertainment. Well within 24 hours of that change, anyway. The date was April 14th, 1970, about a day after the oxygen tank explosion on Apollo 13. What happened? Well, all three TV networks were covering the potential disaster aboard Odyssey and Aquarius. After the first 24 hours, there was really little to report. It was a waiting game. With no new information, by definition, there's no news. The networks, not wanting to lose audience, were vamping until ready. As I recall, CBS and NBC were going over the science, but this was getting boring and repetitive. ABC, however, always in last place for news coverage, decided to go a different route and started to create its own news. Rather than reporting the boring science as the two other networks continued to do, ABC decided to track down and interview the parents of astronaut Jack Swigert. They asked Mr. and Mrs. Swigert how they were feeling with their son hurtling around the moon in a dead space capsule and maybe dying in space. ABC opened up the seam of a television gold mine. Then it became man-on-the-street interviews. How is the world feeling? It was picked up by all three networks, and all of a sudden it wasn't news. It was features. It was filler. It was entertaining fluff. Sure, it can be appealing, and even maybe fulfill some human instinct, but it's not news. Early on, CNN learned that news coverage doesn't transfer well to TV. In 1980, when CNN first broadcast, they ran half-hour news blocks, repeated and updated as new information became available. But it's not interesting watching a talking head read the news. CNN learned this quickly. Features and human interest stories started to fill a space. Then came the most damaging, and maybe the most useless content, speculative news for the purpose of sensationalism. Some say the primary reason why broadcast and now print news has changed to sensationalism is for advertising dollars. Sensationalism and speculation are entertaining. It increases viewership and readership, thereby increasing advertising revenue. Personally, I have a differing view on why the news has become sensationalism. Perhaps it's a bit more jaded. You see, true journalism requires long, hard research and education. Sensationalism only requires speculation. And that holds true for both producer and consumer of both content types. It's easier to create and consume sensationalism than journalism. Journalism is hard work. Not that those that produce sensationalism don't work hard, but it's easier to speculate about stories than it is to find hard facts. Finding facts takes time, and human nature is not very patient. As an airplane geek, it pains me to keep up with the news of a plane crash. It offends me to hear speculation about a pilot committing suicide by airplane before we have any real facts about it. or that the silly idea about a pilot taking control of a 777 full of passengers to secretly land it on a mysterious island would even make it to a news report about MH370. The fact is, there are many different reasons for a plane to come down unexpectedly. It's insulting to me that what we currently refer to as news reporting agencies seem to always assume there's a terrorist plot without any true evidential information. Think American Airlines 587, and more recently, Egypt Air 804. I find it even more offensive that this sometimes happens decades after a crash, even when all the evidence is in. To hear about missiles in the TWA 800 crash years after the scientific investigation was fully concluded disgusts me. Whenever this kind of news story breaks, I think back on the conversation I had with my dad, and I think about the principles of Occam's razor. I keep my ears tuned to the news, looking for horses, not thinking of zebras. More importantly, however, when any big news story breaks, regardless of whether it's an airplane crash, a mass shooting, a building explosion, or any other breathtaking, spectacular story, I try to tune out the commercial spew of information until such time as there's real news from unbiased, vetted, and investigative sources. This is critical and something we should really all try to do. It's even more important that government officials, especially those holding or seeking elected office like presumptive presidential candidates, pay attention to facts only and not create policies or make inflammatory statements about terrorism prior to a complete scientific investigation. We don't need another TSA, the Three Stooges administration, and the security theater that comes along with it. Keep the news filled with facts based on research and good reporting from multiple vetted sources. Let it be boring, and allow it to take the time it needs. Leave sensationalism, muckraking, speculation, and rumors to the world of entertainment and fiction. For the Airplane Geeks in Portland, this is your main man, Micah.
Okay, here's a bonus piece from Micah that we hope you'll like.
It's a regular breakfast thing. We try to do it at least monthly, my radio refugee friend and I. We've both been involved with radio for all our lives. We enjoy each other's company and talk about many different things. It's like being co-hosts of our own radio show. The conversation can go on forever, and often does. There have been times when breakfast changed to lunch and we had no idea. We were just talking. I'm sure you've had those kinds of conversations over a meal, over beers or drinks, sometimes just over coffee. You know how comfortable it can get with the right people or persons. It's like family, or even closer. What do you talk about? Could be anything. For us, it might be sports. I've never really been a big sports fan. I mean, I enjoy some American football, but then my friend tutored me in baseball, which I've come to appreciate. Most times we talk about the silliness of life, like why I have to pay a separate fee for a cable box, something you can't watch cable TV without, can't buy anywhere else, yet the cable company charges you a separate fee for it. How can they do that? Where do they get their nerve? Charging me for something I can't not have, something that I have to have if I buy their service. I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, no, see how the conversation goes sometimes? I couldn't even help myself there. Better not get me started. I can go on for hours, and my radio refugee friend is the same way, so often we do. As old radio guys, we're also both news junkies. We talk about day-to-day news, politics, the nuttiness of the presidential race in the USA, how, you know, well, I better stop there again before I get going on another rant. But my friend knows I'm an airplane geek, and sometimes he'll bring up a news story about aviation. Unfortunately, he's not an airplane geek at all, and the conversation often goes something like this when he says, "Did you hear about the Army blimp that got away in Maryland?" "No," I say, "there was no Army blimp that got away." "Yeah, I read in the news. It flew for miles, took out a bunch of power lines." "Oh, you mean the aerostat?" "Aerostat?" "Well, a balloon is an aerostat. Any balloon really is an aerostat. Anything that flies, it's lighter than air. But the word aerostat is most commonly used for a balloon with an aerodynamic shape, sort of like a barrage balloon, like you picture in your mind tethered over London when you think of the Battle of Britain." "Yeah, so a blimp." "No, not powered. No pilot, no gondola, no engine, no controls other than the tether, so not a blimp." "Oh, you mean an airship?" "Well, kind of. An airship is usually a dirigible, like the Navy's USS Akron or USS Macon. Both were destroyed by storms in the early 1930s. "Oh, yeah, the Navy had Zeppelins back then." "No, no, they didn't have Zeppelins." Well, sort of. After World War I, Goodyear purchased about two-thirds of the Zeppelin Company, and it was that part of Goodyear, the Goodyear Zeppelin Corporation, that built the Akron and the Macon. But Zeppelin is a trademark word, like Jell-O or Kleenex. A Zeppelin is a dirigible made by the Zeppelin Company. The Hindenburg was a Zeppelin, and of course the Graf Zeppelin was a Zeppelin. You see, the difference between a blimp and a dirigible is that a dirigible is rigid and filled with gas bags to make it float. If you let the gas out of a dirigible, it still maintains its shape. Blimps, on the other hand, keep their shape through pressure and only when filled with gas, helium these days. Oh, so the Hindenburg was a big blimp. No, the Hindenburg was an airship, a dirigible, made by Zeppelin. At one time, the Navy flew blimps, originally for offshore submarine patrol. And Goodyear flew blimps commercially, but not so much anymore. There are quite a few others that fly blimps, too. MetLife, DirecTV. What do you mean, not so much anymore? I hear Goodyear just got a new blimp. No. In fact, they got a Zeppelin. All the time on TV, they say Goodyear blimp. Yeah, they were right, but not anymore. Goodyear just got a new dirigible, an airship. It's made by Zeppelin, so it's a Zeppelin. And it's a dirigible, not a blimp. Okay, let's try again. So Goodyear got a Zeppeli? Well, someone at Goodyear may have gotten a Zeppeli. Frankly, I wouldn't mind having one now. A Zeppeli is a big fried Italian donut, like a beignet or a fritter. Do you want some more coffee? And so it goes. For the Airplane Geeks in Portland, this is your main man, Micah.
That's it for this episode. Thank you all for listening. This has been episode 403 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/403. We'd like to mention that there are many ways you can listen to this podcast. Visit airplanegeeks.com and use the player there. Or you can listen to us on Stitcher.com or TuneIn Radio. You can also subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, Google Play, or your favorite iOS or Android podcast app, such as Pocket Casts or Downcast. If you subscribe this way, each new episode will be automatically downloaded to your mobile device, ready to listen to when you are. If you'd like to access downloadable archives of our back catalog, visit airplanegeeks.com/archive. Or you can write Brian at brian@airplanegeeks.com if you'd like hard media. You can visit airplanegeeks.com to find links to us on social media, as well as how to contact us. Also, we'd like to say that there are several ways you can support the Airplane Geeks podcast. You can help us spread the word. Tell people you know about the show. Mention us in social media. You can also write a review in iTunes or Stitcher.com and other places as well. If you'd like to provide financial support, visit our webpage and click the donate button. You should know that we use these funds to help advance the podcast. We don't take donations and simply put that money in our pockets. Donations are used for expenses like media and website hosting, promotional materials, and to help defray some of the travel and hotel expenses for this year's Innovations in Flight Day at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. We'd especially like to express our sincere gratitude to those of you who have made a donation to the podcast. Okay, with that, our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. Find more of his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at brunomassone.com. So join us again next week as we return to our normal format on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody. There's no outtakes this episode. That would be kind of weird, wouldn't it? Just me goofing up? No humor in that. Okay, I know you're disappointed. So here's this. This is from the last episode of the UAV Digest that David and I recorded. Wow, David, that was a fantastic interview. Oh, dear.
Okay, try again.
Let's do that again. All right. We want to thank all of you for listening. This has been episode 149 of the UAV Digest.
It sounded to me like you said UAV Igest.
UAV Igest?
That's what
she says. I said UAV Igest. This has been episode 149 of the UAV Digest. Find us at the UAVDigest.com and show notes for this episode at the UAVDigest.com/148.
No, 149.
149. Find us at the UAVDigest.com. Show notes for this episode at something somewhere. Who cares? This has been episode 149 of the UAV Digest. Find us at the UAVDigest.com. Find show notes for this episode at the UAVDigest.com/149. I'm done. What a mess.